there we were, you know, in the river at port. We'd jump in the 206 and take off up the river and then, you know, climb to probably 3,000 feet or whatever it was. And, you know, jumping out of the float plane was awesome. You step out the door and then all of a sudden you're walking up and down the floats, you know, and going, wow, this is amazing. And then whenever you're ready, you just sort of pile off the side, you know, so.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 18 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. Great to have you all back for another amazing episode. Wasn't Dion's story so detailed and incredible? Hearing from a lot of you about how you love that episode. So thanks very much for the feedback. Don't forget everyone to get in touch. My email hasn't changed. It's still thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. And like always, you can find me on Instagram @thatmallardguy. Had some great suggestions actually for some very cool guests this week. So I'll have to start tracking them down to get in contact and hear some more cool seaplane stories for sure. But first, folks, the following seaplane company will be hidden in darkness no longer as we turn on the Seaplane Spotlight. Alrighty, everyone. So the Seaplane Spotlight shines the light on a seaplane operation anywhere in the world. To have your company featured or to give a shout out to a company you love, get in contact through the channels I spoke of before. This week we head to the south of Australia, to the state of Tasmania, where we'll find Above and Beyond Seaplanes. The foundations of Above and Beyond Tasmania began forming in early 2016 around the dinner table between father and son, Gerald and Henry Ellis. Once committing to the idea, many processes had to be ticked off one by one before they undertook a two-year quest to find, purchase and deliver an operational aircraft to their base in Hobart. With the help of their small but valuable team, the doors officially opened and the first commercial flight took place on the 19th of December 2018. They operate one amphibious Beaver float plane with one full-time pilot and two casuals. They offer charter to several resorts around the state, as well as scenic flights over some of Australia's most beautiful scenery, including the Southwest Wilderness Heritage Area and the Gordon River, to name a few. Above and Beyond are also able to do seaplane ratings on the Beaver as well. Cool fact is that Henry Ellis is actually a Virgin Australia 737 pilot who built this business up whilst flying for Virgin. Another very cool story of an airline pilot wanting to get back into general aviation seaplane flying. Good on you, Henry. Maybe we'll get him on the show one time in the near future to talk all about what it's like to start a company like Above and Beyond. If you would like to check them out, you can see them on Instagram @aboveandbeyondtasmania or on their website aboveandbeyond.flights. That, folks, is the Seaplane Spotlight. Okay, everyone, it's time to get to the main event. Today's guest is Lloyd Cofield. His career has taken him around the world as an Australian skydiver, as well as chief pilot of Air Whitsunday, and then onto the Mallard. He loves to tell a story and makes for a great interview. Folks, let's strap on our parachute. After climbing up to 1,000 feet, we'll jump out of the plane and land on the beach before running over to the seaplane to do it all over again by getting on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Alrighty, welcome to On The Step, Lloyd Cofield. How you going, mate?
I'm good, thanks, Dan. I'm good.
Great to have you on the show, mate. Very excited to dive deep into your seaplane history, mate. It includes some Mallards, a bit of time at Air Whitsunday. We've covered a lot of that already in this series, so going to be great to hear it from your perspective. Mate, why don't we start off with where you are right now and what you're doing in your career at this time?
Right, yep. Well, I'm Rockhampton, Queensland. I'm an RFDS pilot for RFDS Queensland. Been here just about to tick over 8 years at the Rockhampton base, so yeah, loving it actually. Really enjoy the RFDS flying and the way of life, so yeah, things are going quite well.
It's a bit of a pathway, isn't it? Like, I guess a lot of those guys, RFDS, they kind of come from a background of more hands-on flying like seaplanes, really, don't they?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels in it. You know, I think back to a lot of the skills that you develop over the time, and it attracts those people that have got that little bit of a, you know, a left field attraction to aviation. They're not really chasing the airline dream. I mean, look, having said that, we certainly we've got some very senior people that have gone off and, you know, done the airline routine and decided that they want to, you know, step sideways and come back. And, you know, it's a very mixed bunch. But, yeah, generally speaking, somebody who does enjoy the more hands-on and the more unpredictable, you know. Yeah. I liken it in a lot of ways to the Airwick Sunday routine. You know, you're never at your destination until you actually land, you know, when you're halfway there and the phone goes and then it's all of a sudden you're off somewhere else and doing something else, you know. And as you well know, you know, Airwick Sunday, there was a lot of chaos days there where, you know, you're halfway to the reef but then something else needs to get moved and you're dropping people here and there and, you know, racing over to Hayman to pick up some bags because the transfer's gone and the bags got left behind. Or, you know, I think that I often laugh about that bit of, you know, parallel in the chaos of the two operations sometimes.
No, that's fair enough. And you do a bit of skydiving stuff on the side as well?
Yes, I don't do a hell of a lot these days, but, you know, I was actually skydiving before I was flying. So that's been a very sort of, you know, parallel journey. I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, really, to be honest, that was the initial interest. I mean, I'd done, you know, thousands of hours sitting in the back of aeroplanes before I got a pilot license. So, you know, and along that way, you know, you get to do all these cool trips and jump out of some very cool aeroplanes and travel all around the world. And I think it just sort of seated that bit of a sense of adventure to go and, you know, do something that little bit different. So stepped back from it for a while, started doing a bit more during my time in Darwin on the Mallard again, and then come down here. And again, a couple of quiet years there really wasn't anything in the area. But yeah, we've got a small operation here, bit of a side gig. So yeah, there's another couple of guys that jump here regularly and still keep my hand in that a little bit as well.
Happy days. So in the back of a plane before getting into the pilot seat, mate, when did you actually take that jump into the pilot seat?
We were in the sort of late 90s. Was full on into the competition mode with skydiving and, you know, got to do some international competition and all that sort of stuff. And it was, but I think with that recognition too of, okay, well, this is coming to an end and what's the next chapter and what are you going to do now? And, you know, by this stage, we'd been running around, you know, all over the country and, you know, in twin otters and porters and the turbine beaver, if you've seen that getting around. There's a one-off Australian conversion, and that's owned by a good mate of mine now. That's getting a really smick rebuild. That'll be back in the air in the next month or two. But, you know, we'd flown, you know, up through Darwin and back down through Mount Isa and back to Sydney and, you know, just doing all these amazing trips in these very cool aeroplanes and then starting to think, well, you know, what I want to see the other side of it. I want to be able to get into flying these things as well, not just jumping out of them. And, you know, I think there'd always been a solid interest in aviation. I mean, you know, I left school at 16 and joined the Air Force and was working on aeroplanes from that age. But, you know, it did take a while to sort of commit to the pilot routine. But, yeah, once I jumped into it, I loved it. It was great. Never looked back.
Yeah, right. And where were you doing all this? Was this in Queensland as well, was it?
The actual when I started flying, so I did my all my pilot training at Port Macquarie. We were running a small operation there. So I did my private there, and then pretty cool one actually. We were just as I completed my private, I was actually doing a bit of coaching for some guys in Perth in Western Australia. So I did a bit of a deal, and you know, said, well, okay, it's going to cost you this much to fly me over there and all that. Why don't you just give me that towards hiring this aeroplane and I'll fly myself over. So I jumped in the 172 and flew from Port Macquarie across to Perth and did a couple of weeks coaching and then flew home again. So, you know, that was, that was awesome. Good way to
That would have been a good fun nav, yeah.
Yeah, not a bad one to do, you know. And that was, I mean, I think had a, you know, probably the very first generation GPS on the floor there, you know, but the, you know, the brief was that wasn't to come out unless you really, really needed it. So it was all the, you know, the one in 60s and the old school. So yeah, it was great fun.
And then what got you into float planes, mate? Was that, you know, because you're a bit out there with the skydiving and everything and, you know, you wanted a bit more adventure in your flying or?
Definitely that. I think the, you know, when I look back, I think it was always everything that I was attracted to was that little bit more adventurous side. And, you know, I think the floats, when we were in Port Macquarie, there was a float plane there and Bill Lane was there for a little while. And I remember in we decided to, you know, try and do these, always looking for a bit of fun. And we were doing this competition where you had to, you know, jump out of the aeroplane, land on the beach, you know, do an accuracy competition, then throw on the wetsuit, grab the board and run out and do a surf competition. And we called it the parasurf. And we thought, you know, that's pretty cool. That'd be great fun. And then we're sort of looking around and then, you know, we thought, wouldn't it be cool not to have to run back and forwards to the airport all the time? So we went and approached Bill, who had the 206 there, and said, mate, can we jump out of the 206? And he goes, yeah, sure, why not? So there we were, you know, in the river at port. We jump in the 206 and take off up the river and then, you know, climb to probably 3,000 feet or whatever it was. And, you know, jumping out of the float plane was awesome. You step out the door and then all of a sudden you're walking up and down the floats, you know, and going, wow, this is amazing. And then whenever you're ready, you just sort of pile off the side, you know. So
Like standing on the float in flight? Like I've always kind of thought, you know, you open the window of a 206, for example, and there's a gale force of air just going past the window there, and you're like, your hand gets sucked back. What's it like actually being out on the float there?
It's, look, when it's flown properly and when it's managed properly, it's not as bad as that. You find that, you know, such a large percentage of that is from the prop wash. So if you get the plane powered back a bit and you get rid of that thrust from the prop, you know, I mean, you've still got to hang on, obviously, but you can, you know, you can stand out there and drag your way up and down and, you know, grab hold of a couple of other people and then bail out. So, yeah. It was that was cool. I do remember, you know, that being just looking at the float plane world then and going, wow, how cool is this? And, you know, I remember Bill then in the river there, we're starting to get, you know, the little rollers coming through the river and Bill saying, you know, hey, it's starting to get pretty rough here and we're going to have to go further up the river. And that sort of awareness where you're sort of going, well, geez, it doesn't look rough to me. There's hardly a wave there, but going, wow, okay, fair enough. And, you know, you think about that later on in your float plane world and, you know, when you start to talk about reading conditions and waves and all that and you think, wow, you know, I didn't even hardly notice that, but here's this very experienced guy saying, hey, this is starting to have an effect. So, yeah, definitely some interest there. And then following on from that, around that same time, I went up to Airlie Beach and I was actually I was doing tandems up there full time. But, you know, about that same time, I mean, you know what Airlie Beach is like. You get up there and there's just planes and helicopters and there's just, you know, all the tourism. And, you know, Airlie Beach was certainly boom times at that time. And in the middle of all that, here's these beavers coming in and out, you know. And because I've done so many jumps from the turbine beaver and then you're going, hey, this is the real thing and this is on floats and, you know, the rattly old radial and you're going, wow. That actually looks pretty cool, you know, and you're hearing them all, you know, because I was doing some flying then as well. I was flying and jumping. And, you know, you're on the radio hearing these guys, you know, coming out of Whitehaven or coming out of the reef or coming out of Hayman. And then, you know, I just sort of got the bug a little bit from there, I guess, and went, hey, you know, I've got to go and do an endorsement. I really wasn't 100% that I wanted to chase it full time or anything like that, but I certainly wanted to do that endorsement and see what it was like. So I went and did the endorsement with John Davies and we're there with Sunday. And yeah, again, just loved it. It was fantastic.
Yeah. Right. So, and just stepping back before we talk about that transition into the float world, like the skydiving kind of work that you were doing there, was that good enough and lucrative enough there to make a full-time living out of?
Yeah, yep, absolutely. We were making good money doing tandems at Airlie Beach. And, I mean, it was pretty unique at that time. I mean, there was a couple. Cairns is probably similar at the time, but there wasn't a lot of places around that were 7 days flat out. I mean, you know, Airlie Beach, it didn't matter if it was Monday, Wednesday or Sunday. There was just people everywhere and the place was go, go, go. So, you know, we were jumping every single day. There was, you know, there'd be obviously your weather days and all that, but it was very small in those days. It was just a 182. There was me and one other guy in the 182, and we'd just go flat out all day long. And then, you know, every sort of month or 6 weeks, there was another guy that would drop in and, you know, he'd sort of take someone's slot for 3, 4, 5 days or whatever to give you a break and then you'd jump straight back into it. So, yeah, no, it was was busy, but yeah, great, good fun times. But that, I mean, you know, as you well know, Airlie Beach is well known as being windy, and
yeah, exactly.
the strip there down in the bottom of the valley, yeah, and it can be a hard and very tricky place to jump. Yeah. So you know, it was hard work at the same time. I mean, a lot of fun, but hard work at times.
Yeah, my first jump was supposed to be in Early Beach, mate, but it got blown out. Couldn't even jump at Proserpine in the end, which I didn't really want to do anyway as a backup, but I was actually getting really amped up for it, and then it got cancelled. And then didn't end up doing my first jump until a few years later. Actually, it was last year in New Zealand out at Queenstown. And absolutely loved it. I'd do that again in a heartbeat. Literally got down from the flight and was just, can we go again? You know, it's a very addictive thing. And I'm not usually good with heights, even being a pilot. That's a funny thing to say, but most pilots are like that, I think, deep down. But another funny story about Airlie, mate, you know, my wife, Jenna, you know her, and she's a helicopter pilot. She actually went, this was before I went to do the skydive out of Airlie Beach, but she was actually taking the 22 up, I think, the helicopter there to go and find a few of the cutaways. And after doing a few of those, she really wasn't that keen on me jumping out.
Yeah, that I remember doing the same thing. I think, what was I in? I think it might have even been in the Tiger Moth or something, but, you know, it's just so full on with the rainforest and everything else that, you know, I mean, you do from time to time have cutaways. The gear these days is, you know, so amazing. The engineering in it, you'd just be, I can't even keep up with it. You know, it's incredible what they're doing now with all these computer cutting machines, and it's the technology in parachutes these days is just out of control. It's incredible. But, you know, so what was I? Probably 20 years ago now that I was jumping there. And I mean, the technology then was good. It had come a long way. But, you know, every now and then something just doesn't work properly. And, you cut the parachute away. It's not a big deal. It's one handle, second handle to open the reserve and away you go. The reserve's essentially the same as the main, and it's really not a big deal. But somewhere like Airlie, because it's down in that valley and the parachute drifts off and, you know, without fail, it ends up a tree. And then, you know, there's trying to get through that rainforest. I mean, these canopies are worth a lot of money. So, you know, you go to great lengths to find them. But, they're nearly always in the top of a tree. And, you know, the guy that I was working for at the time, he had a pretty good deal with one of the tree climbers in town, you know, and they'd come out with the spikes and the belt and, you know, up the tree they'd go. And, you'd get this canopy back and, you know, check it out, repack it, and off you go again.
Yeah, right. Mate, I guess I can't really go past, you know, being a non-skydiver. Have you got some sort of, what's your craziest story skydiving? There's got to be something that you've done in your career.
Mate, there's one or two that, you know, will probably have to stay under the cap, but... but no, look, it was, you know, I'm in from a, you know, from an achievement point of view. I mean, we got to go and represent Australia, you know, overseas. We went to competition. We trained in the States. We went to competitions in, you know, across Europe, in France, in Spain. We went to Turkey for one. And, you know, along those routes, you know, the people that you meet and the things that you do. I mean, you know, Arizona, there we were in the absolute middle of nowhere in Eloy, Arizona, halfway between Phoenix and Tucson. And, you know, you get out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning because it's summer and you head out to the drop zone and there's a Pilatus Porter there, the competition aircraft that year. And, you know, you've got basically your private Porter and you jump in and you just go, go, go. And, you know, you do your 10 or 12 jumps or whatever. And then, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon when it gets really hot, off you go to the gym and sort of try and hide out and stay fit and, you know, get up and do it all over again. And then on the weekend, you know, duck down to Tucson and go rock climbing or something. And, you know, that was just incredible times. I mean, for, you know, somebody or anyone looking for that bit of an adventure. And, you know, over there, I mean, you're training alongside, you know, the Japanese team or the German team or, you know, whoever it is. And, you know, the best of the world were all there. And, you know, the Americans were full-time sponsored and they were, you know, the Americans and the French were the best at the time. And, yeah, just, you know, amazing sort of stories and stuff. But, you know, just hanging out with some of the best skydivers in the world and, you know, quite a few of those that we still regularly stay in touch with now. So, but... The back of one of those big training camps, the guy that ran the drop zone, I mean, they had, you know, twin otters and a fleet of twin otters, but they had the DC-3 there as well. And, you know, it was a bit of a novelty. They didn't really use it for, you know, that often. But anyway, they said, oh, as a thank you for everybody that's been here and, you know, spent a lot of money, et cetera, we'll come out and we're going to have this barbecue. So everybody sort of wandered out expecting this little bit of a barbecue and a beer and whatever. And anyway, they go, oh, just round the back of the hangar there. So we all wander around and they're like, right, get in. And so there's about, you know, 30 of us or whatever it was. We all jump in the back of the DC-3 and it's, you know, there's Eskies and everything else there for a drink and then fire it up and off we go. And this is all at night and, you know, take us up to Phoenix and there's this one of the back airports there, there's this amazing restaurant where they, you know, we taxi up in the DC-3, open the door, down the ladder into this, you know, aviation-themed restaurants where they're all got World War II, you know, era outfits and everything. And, yeah, it was just incredible. You're going, wow, can't believe I'm here for this one.
Yeah. America does aviation so good, don't they? Like, oh, they can put on some good stuff over there.
That's fantastic. I mean, you know, I think – You've done Oshkosh as well, I think. That
no, I haven't yet, mate. No, I can't wait, though. It's definitely on the list.
Yes, definitely spent a little bit of time at the seaplane base at Oshkosh. That was fantastic.
Did you see the Mars there at all, by any chance?
No. But we did a fair bit of tripping around Canada as well, and I'm pretty sure that I've seen it on the water there somewhere in Canada.
You couldn't miss it, really, could you?
No, big aeroplane. But, yes, excellent. So... You know, that was sort of the skydiving days anyway, I guess. You know, lots of, you know, just lots of adventure, lots of cool aeroplanes. And, you know, along the way, it's, you know, all about, you know, the turbine and let's go higher and let's climb faster and, you know, let's fly the turbine. So I think there was always that, you know, that interest and that seated sort of, you know, let's get behind the controls of one of these turbine aeroplanes and go and have some fun.
So how old were you when you took that transition from skydiving into, you know, really looking at becoming a pilot full-time and making a career of it?
That was basically late 20s. So it was a bit of a late start for the chasing the flying. So I think I was about 28 when I finished my commercial and then went on from there.
Yeah, it's not, you know, I guess you'd call that a bit of a change in career, really, couldn't you?
Yes, it was, it was
in aviation, but it's a bit, still a change.
Yeah. And it was at that time, I mean, look, as I say, you know, the competition days were, you know, we decided that year was going to be our last competition year as a team. And then it's, you know, that decision of what else do I do? And I mean, you know, I was loving the skydiving, don't get me wrong. I mean, I still do it as we said, but also the recognition that, you know, it is hard on your body and you know, you're going to struggle to do that for another 30 or 40 years. And, you know, you do need to go and do something else. And then, you know, I guess that was a driver. And because I wanted to start, you know, flying the jump plane anyway, but normally you need 200 hours minimum. If you're an experienced skydiver, there's a waiver for 120, but I knew I had to do at least 120. So at that stage, you could do the commercial in 150. So I thought, why waste all those hours flying around in, you know, in circles, essentially doing really not much, put a bit more effort in and do the commercial. And then if you do decide that you really want to chase that, then you've always got it. So that was the motivation behind doing the commercial.
So, mate, you got your float endorsement there with John Davies out of Airwit Sunday. How long was it before you actually got a gig flying floats?
It was basically about 6 months later. So we'd gone and done the endorsement and yeah, look, I just loved it. We were, you know, here, there and everywhere and out the back at Proserpine Dam and doing the freshwater stuff out there. And yeah, I was just amazed at how much fun it was. So anyway, sort of left it at that and I was just, you know, continuing jumping and flying and everything else. And then, yeah, it was about 6 months later, they, you know, I mean, you see the guys every afternoon and in the cafe and have a chat and, you know, what's going on and, you know, just being friends, really, not sort of essentially chasing the job, but just saying good day. And there was other people working there that I knew at the time. I mean, Dan Halliwell was there. He'd been a jump pilot, you know, earlier on when I was jumping full time. He was one of the pilots. And yeah, so you just get to know everybody. And then it was about 6 months later, they said, hey, we're thinking about putting someone on, bit of a traineeship type thing. What do you think? What are you going to do? And, you know, you sort of don't think too much about those ones, I don't think, do you? You just go, well, no. Sure, let's go. And that was it, jumped over there. And yeah, that was the start of the Airwet Sunday routine.
Yeah, right. I think I left my old man with about a week's notice once I got the Airwet job. But so, mate, you got your dream job there or dream float job now, I guess, flying at Airwet Sunday. What was it like getting into the commercial float flying world, and what kind of stuff were you doing out of there, Whit?
It was great. I mean, look, you know, you would have went there with some, you know, amount of decent experience. I mean, look, I essentially went there with nothing. I had the bare endorsement, which was, you know, 6 hours, whatever it was. And I really, you know, was just completely out of my depth. I mean, I had 450 hours somewhere there, but, you know, it was all basically up and down in the 182. I mean, I hadn't really done a lot of anything else. And so, you know, it's just so new. And but, you know, it was a very sort of controlled environment. I mean, you did loads and loads of ICAS until you got to an acceptable standard, and then, you know, you went and did scenics, and so they really pushed the scenic flight, so then you could get time in the Beaver, you get to know the area, and you go out to the reef, and you do, we'd do a touch and go or a splash and dash, and, you know, we'd do a landing at the reef, but we weren't allowed to fall off the step. You had to keep it on the plane and, yeah, you know, give everybody the thrill of the water landing, and then off you go and, you know, do loads and loads of scenic flights. And then, you know, building on top of that, start with the ICAS routine and but doing the normal operations then and into, you know, and everywhere as you know, in the wet Sundays, but into Hayman, across to Hamilton, Whitehaven, out to the reef. We had the two different lagoon areas out at the reef, the reef world in the river, and then, you know, Airwick Sunday was great in the, you know, the yacht pickups. I mean, I think back to the yacht pickups, yeah, and think, you know, that they were just amazing. But, you know, you could be picking up off a yacht anywhere. You just get these bookings and people would go, okay, well, I'm in Nara Inlet or I'm in Sid Harbour or wherever it happens to be. And, you know, we'd like to do a reef tour. And so the next morning you'd lob in and pick them up and take them out the reef. And it was, you know, it's one of those things that I think from the person on the yacht's perspective, it had to be just incredible. You know, this float plane appears out of nowhere and circles overhead, and, you know, all of a sudden they land and you jump in the dinghy and let back on a bit of rope, and here comes this Beaver with the prop spinning, you know, and old mate steps out, and, you know, if it goes to plan, nice gentle dock on the boat, and, you know, steps down really cool and, hey, how you going, jump on board, and, you know, half an hour later you're out at the reef snorkeling. It's just the concept around that is just amazing, I think.
Yeah, no, the reef pickups were a highlight, I reckon, of what my time there as well. And they usually tip better as well, didn't they, the old reef pickups?
Hayman was pretty well known in its day. I think Paddy Martin was, yeah, living on the island, yeah, at the time, and, oh, he was the king of the tips. He'd come home with pockets full of cash. Oh, Paddy, how do you do that?
He's a bit of a legend in that area, though, isn't he?
Oh, mate, he knew the island. It was incredible. You know, you'd have, you know, what was it, four rungs, and you could taxi over the reef, you know, but no less. And you'd fly overhead, and there's, you know, four and a half, nearly five rungs, and there's Paddy out over the top of the reef, you know, in the Beaver. Yeah. You're like, mate, how come you can do it and none of us can? And, you know, he'd been out there and he'd snorkeled the reef and he'd walked the reef and he knew where the little high points were and the low points were and he knew what he could get away with. And, yeah, he just knew the place inside out. But, you know, that was great for us that were learning, you know, along following on in those footsteps, because you just had so much experience there that, you know, you'd do something that, you know, wasn't quite right, or, you know, it might have been okay, but there's different ways to do it. And, you know, Paddy and those guys would just, you know, pull you aside and say, hey, you know, do this, do that. And, yeah, it was a great learning curve. And, you know, Duncan was there at the time. Some of my very early or earliest flights, you know, apart from the endorsement, we're with Duncan training. So, you know, you've had a lot to do with Duncan, you know, what the skill set, yeah, there is. And, yeah, it was just, you know, it was just that building of experience. But, yeah, I mean, amazing place. It was just, you'd be up at Hayman, there'd be four aircraft nose to tail coming down the ramp one after the other and, you know, all taxi out through the leads. And, yeah, the sights and everything there were just great in the, you know, in the day when it was going flat out.
And you used to operate in Blue Lagoon as well, did you?
Yeah, so in the when we started, the other lagoon, the lagoon that you guys all operated into, Hardy Lagoon. Yeah. So that was just called Paddy's Lagoon because, you know, essentially no one else went there. I mean, you know, John and Duncan and those guys did, but that was Paddy's Lagoon essentially. So we operated up in next one along in Blue Lagoon. And you know, in the days when I remember going there with Peter Bull, and you know, you had to basically sit down on the bit of paper and you had to be able to draw the lagoon, you know, from memory. You had to know every sort of peak in the reef and where the markers were and where you could taxi, where you couldn't taxi, and where the abort points were. And, you know, you sort of thought, geez, this is, you know, this is pretty full on. But then when you get out there by yourself and it's, you know, it's a glassy day and there's 2 inches of water over the top of the reef and you just can't see anything but those marks, you know, and you really need to know. You turn around that mark, you take up this compass heading, you go to that next mark, and then you turn around and then you take power. And, you know, if I'm not on the step going past that next marker, then that's abort time. And yeah, it was pretty full on in some of those conditions, as you well know. But yeah, so we'd operate there with two, maybe even three aeroplanes at times to the bigger sub there. And then the turning point for that one was the caravan. When we sort of introduced the caravan there, I did a few operations into that lagoon with the caravan, but it's very tight. And then, yeah, you just start thinking, you know, geez, this is a bit full on. I mean, you know, the caravan had the performance, but it's a big aeroplane and that turbine, and in, you know, some of the wind conditions, just docking on the boat because the boat would hang so close to the reef. And you just think, this is, you know, there's a lot at stake here. Let's try and make it a little bit easier. And so we decided to swap the boats over and move the mooring a little bit in the other area and just create a bit more room so that, you know, hopefully people could get in and out of there with not too much excitement. And, it worked really well.
Flying over the two lagoons, I'm surprised that it wasn't just Paddy and Dunk operating in Blue Lagoon and you guys in Hardy, because it looks so much tighter than what was in Hardy Lagoon there. Like, I don't know how you guys did it.
It was tight. Like, don't get me wrong, there's plenty of times and plenty of incidents. There was a couple of times when aeroplanes ended up, you know, on the reef. That was sort of before I started, but there had been incidents there. But you know, during my time, I think the thinking was that, as you know, the Hardy Lagoon was so many isolated bombies, and if you got a bit lost in where you were in that lagoon, there was just traps all over the place. Whereas Blue was certainly smaller, but the edges of the reef were a bit more defined, and that was a little bit easier to sort of keep an eye on where you were. And, you know, the only real incident with the caravan that I can recall, certainly in my time, and it was exactly that. One of the guys, we were headed out the reef. I was in the Beaver that day. One of the other guys had landed in Hardy in the caravan, and then, you know, he's sort of 5 minutes ahead or 10 minutes ahead, and you're sort of wandering your way out there, and then you hear this, you know, Par Golf Alpha airborne at the reef for Shute Harbour, and you think, what's going on there? I'm supposed to be meeting him. And so, you know, you jump on the discrete frequency and call up and said, what's going on, mate? I'm supposed to be meeting you there. And he said, oh, I've hit the reef. And anyway, I was like, oh, well, you know, you're airborne, so it can't be that bad. What's the story? He said, he felt it hit the reef, felt it tear up the side of the floats, and he just basically really, you know, good management and good luck. But he, where it happened was basically at the start of the run. Taxied back, got a bit distracted, hit the reef, ripped a great hole in the floats, but was in the right spot where all he had to do was kick it around and basically firewall it. And, you know, he got it airborne, which was great, because had it been anywhere else that required a taxi or where he couldn't just take power straight away, it would have been a whole different story, because it was a pretty good gash in the floats. He was, you know, he wasn't real confident on how much damage he'd done. So, you know, I said, look, just keep it calm, slow it down a bit. You know, I'm in the Beaver, I'm going to struggle to catch up. But, you know, just got him to, you know, get it all slowed down, keep heading my way. And then I just tucked up underneath him in the Beaver and had a look and said, yep, I certainly wouldn't be putting it on the water again. But so long as you go to Shute Harbour, I don't think you'll have a problem. But it had done a lot of damage. It was about three compartments in the floats from memory that were opened up. So, you know, if he had stayed on the water, there would have been a much worse outcome. But anyway, he got back to Shute Harbour, and you know, the gear all came down fine and put it on the dirt, and you know, so we had a caravan on wheels there for a little while, which was different, but yeah.
I'll actually put it on the wheels, did they?
Well, because we took it off the floats while the floats got repaired and dumped it on the wheels. And yeah, it's quite funny. I remember, you know, the day that, must have been, you know, whenever that was, a few days after that, but the first time you drive in the airport and you see the caravan sitting there on wheels and you're like, wow, check that out. Look how small it is.
Yeah.
It looked like a 182, you know, and then I ended up, and I think I only ever flew it, I don't know, maybe three or four times, but, you know, did a few hours on the caravan on wheels, and, you know, just amazing. You get in this thing and, you know, get airborne, and all of a sudden you're doing, you know, 160, 170 knots, and you're climbing like something else because, you know, you're not dragging these big heavy floats around now. So, yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, I spent over 24 hours at the reef one day after a beaver had hit the reef and tore some holes in both floats, actually, and then we couldn't get it airborne and, yeah, had to spend over 24 hours there. Didn't get it out until the next night, so spent the night there at the reef looking after the beaver to keep it floating. It was always the case of if you feel anything touch the reef, it's just get it airborne as quick as possible.
Yeah,
and get it back to land, because yeah, you never know what's going to happen on the water there.
Yeah, no, there's the reef's claimed a few out there. That's for sure. But I mean, you know, as you know, it's such a, you know, for so many operations that were done there over such a length of time. I mean, you know, obviously you're going to have a few instances in that, but you know, overall, I mean, when you consider the number and the loads, I mean, you know, we used to take such big loads into that end lagoon, which you say is, you know, some pretty small runs there, and you'd be taking six people with, you know, 450 kilo type thing, and yeah, it was full on some days, wasn't it?
Yeah, and mate, so you were there at the introduction of the caravans, eh?
Yes, yep. So that was about the time that I took over from Dunk, and Dunk headed up to Mallard. So most of
you
that...
You took over as chief, were you?
Yeah, took over as chief pilot there when Dunk left. Yeah. So pretty much all of that initial caravan stuff I got to do, which was unreal. Like I think back now and think, you know, that was, if I've got to say some highlights from all of the seaplane type stuff that you do, I mean, for me, the caravan was, it rates up there, you know, very highly, that's for sure. It was just so cool. You're in, you know, I mean, the beaver's big enough, all of a sudden you're in this caravan on amphibs and you sit so high, and you know, yeah. Then you're cruising along and you've got the turbine and you've got the aircon and you're doing 135 knots, you know. It was well, you're not getting overtaken by helicopters anymore, you know.
The
44s used to overtake the beaver, so
oh yeah, absolutely.
You'd be like, hey, I'm the king of the kids, you know, I'm doing 135 knots, this is unreal.
Climbing up to 4,000, geez, how good was that?
I remember the, you know, take off out of Hardy, and as you say, just climb before you sort of head back east, and all of a sudden the reef, you go, mate, I've been here for 5 years and I've never seen the reef from this high. Like it's incredible, because you know, when you never get the beaver over 1500 feet, would you? So
no, exactly.
You know, 1500 feet, you're starting to get a nosebleed, but yeah. But yeah, so that was, you know, I loved the caravan. I mean, we had Adrian Billings from up Townsville and Orpheus and come down and do the endorsement, and but it was it was a very interesting sort of learning curve, because you know, he'd done incredible stuff. He'd flown the Nomad on amphibs and done jet time, and you know, was running the caravan IFR out to Orpheus and back and everything. But so you look, he was a very experienced float pilot, seaplane pilot, IFR pilot. But when it come to the Whitsunday or the Air Whitsunday operation in particular, it was it was just different. I mean, everybody gets to know their own neck of the woods and what works and what doesn't. And you know, we'd gone out and we'd been flying around. We'd, you know, done all the sequences and done all the landings and, you know, cruising around Whitehaven. And he basically says, well, you know, we still need to knock off another couple of hours. Is there anything that you want to do? And I said, well, you know, we have to find out how this is going to work for our operation. So let's go up to Hayman and let's go and put it down the leads and let's ramp it and get up the top of the ramp there at Hayman and just see how it all works, you know. And I'm thinking, I want somebody to tell me how to do this, because this is all of a sudden we're sitting in this $2.5-3 million aeroplane, and you know, if I put that prop in the wrong place, we're going to do a lot of damage. And so, you know, I'm wanting all these pointers on how to do this. You know, I mean, I'd measured out the wingspan and I'd stepped it out, and you know, if it works for the beaver, it should work for the caravan. But we'd never done it; it hadn't been done. And so, anyway, we wander up to Hayman there and put it on the water out the front and start pointing it towards the leads. And I said, all right, mate, so how do we do this? And he basically gently slid the seat back and said, I've got no idea. This is yours from here on. I thought, right, okay, well, fair enough. So anyway, away we went. You know, you point it down the leads and go, well, somebody's got to do it. We've got to find out. And, you know, all the theory said it should work. And anyway, you know, get it down the leads, get it through the marina there, and give it the herbs up the ramp, and it all worked without any drama. But, you know, it was the pressure was certainly on. That was good fun. And, you know, the first time out at the lagoon, the first docking on the boats, you know, figuring out how to do all that. And we'd talked a lot about, you know, should we get some expertise from elsewhere? Should we? And we'd actually gone to the point of doing a bit of advertising, you know, should we get somebody from elsewhere that's got all this good sort of caravan turbine time and all that. But in the end, we just went, well, you know what, we know the operation, and, you know, hopefully we don't screw up anything too much with the turbine. But it was, look, it was definitely a learning curve. But as you well know, the caravan just fitted into that operation really well. I mean, you know, if there was something that was a bit of an issue, it was the very short sectors and the cycle times on the engine. But as far as actually operating the aircraft, it was great. You know, all of a sudden there's just so many things that you can do, and you know, the economics, taking 10 people, I mean, it added a lot. It was hard work at the same time. I mean, you know, the Beaver out of Hayman, you've got 5 maybe 6 people, all of a sudden you've got 10, maybe even 11, you know, and a 25 knots, and the anchor's dragging, and, you know, nobody falling tired, and people don't want to get their feet wet, and their umbrellas blown away, and you're trying to serve champagne with the other hand, and, you know, you're just going, oh my God, you know, this is too much. There's too many people. But
and then don't forget, like, taking them out to the reef. I mean, I think I had once, I was in the caravan or something, and then maybe could have been someone else was in another caravan. You know, there's two of us out there, and then it's a glass out. And so one pilot has to stay with the planes. And then so you're running a snorkeling tour for 20 people all by yourself. You know, it was full on sometimes. And like I said, on the beach, that thing was a heavy plane. If you were kind of mid-beach and a bit of wind blew up, you know, you'd be having fun trying to hold that thing sideways to load passengers. And, you know, it was a big challenge, wasn't it? Different to the Beaver.
Yeah, it was, you know, and I mean, look, even the Beaver on those sort of days was hard work as well, wasn't it? But, you know, I always try, and people say, you know, do you miss floats? And absolutely, without a doubt, I do, you know, but I always temper that with a bit of realism as well. And I think back to those, you know, 30 knot quartering tailwind trying to get the caravan down the leads at Hayman, or, you know, the same conditions at Whitehaven, and, you know, trying to get people on and off the aeroplane and dragging anchors, and, you know, it was hard work.
It's usually you usually kind of wake up in a bit of a quick snap and think, and you're sitting in your King Air up at bloody 20,000 feet, just going, I'm pretty happy here. Like, I miss floats, but it's think life's okay.
I'd love to get one of those float jobs again, you know, like a few people have said. But, you know, the Canadian model where, you know, point A to point B, and you've got a dock hand at the other end. And, you know, I'm sure those guys and girls work very hard as well. But, you know, Airwick Sunday was just unique in that you did everything. You drove the boat, you served the champagne on the beach, you know, you went running up off the beach after the umbrella that's blown away. Like, the, you know, it was a one-man show, and, you know, you did everything. And at times was, as you well know, that was damn hard work.
Mate, I had that a bit in Vietnam, though, like the opposite, like you said, like getting everything done for you, man. I mean, we'd get picked up in Hanoi there in a bus. We get driven straight to the airport. We go straight to the briefing office because they, you know, people would actually be there to give you a weather briefing and everything. That'd be all ready for you. You get to the plane, the engineers are there pumping floats, the refueler's there refueling the plane for you. Literally, I just did a walk around, get in, and then the other end there, like, people would bring stairs up to you, the top of the ramp there. Like, you literally had nothing to do. And when we returned back to Hanoi, we'd actually get on the same bus because we obviously didn't have a gate or anything. We'd be out in the middle of nowhere on the ramp there, and you'd literally get in the same bus that the passengers were leaving on, and you didn't wash the airplane down. The engineers did all of that. They pumped the floats. They tied the plane down. You got it. You were sometimes out of the airport quicker than the passengers. And to be honest, I kind of didn't like that much. It just kind of bored me a fair bit. I kind of like all the stuff in between, you know, serving champagne or, you know, just being interactive with the passengers or even just having things like doing a daily inspection or just getting the plane ready, you know. That kind of stuff actually kind of goes well with the job sometimes.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it's I mean, it just all comes down to the conditions, doesn't it? I mean, you wouldn't trade a thing for that personal interaction side of the tours that we did there. You know, I remember a really funny one at Whitehaven there one day. You know, and of course out of Hayman, you know, plenty of 5-star guests and, you know, very well known celebrities. And, you know, I remember Olivia there one day, you know, after a transfer, you know, would it be okay if I took a photo? You know, yeah, okay, just one. But, you know, it was fantastic. But at Whitehaven there one day and, you know, one of the guys that was on the tour was asking all the, you know, semi-technical questions and et cetera, et cetera. And you end up going, well, you know, you obviously know a fair bit about aviation, you know, do you fly yourself? What's your story? And he says, oh, well, actually, I've just come back from the space station. And that was, you remember that Dennis Tito that paid his own way to go to the space station?
What was his last name?
Tito, I think is how you pronounce it. T-I-T-O, okay. Isn't it? Dennis Tito. But yeah, I think he'd gone up with the Russians and spent a bit of time on the space shuttle and come back down at, you know, a cost of a mil or a couple of mil or whatever it was. Wow. But yeah, I was like, okay, well, that sort of makes my 90 knot beaver look not quite so flash, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, mate, so what happened next after this? So you're chief pilot at Air Whitsunday. Like, how long did you end up in the Whitsundays altogether?
6 years. So there was never really an intention to go anywhere else, I don't think. I mean, as Bowie sort of touched on, there was this fantastic, you know, culture where the newer guys, not everybody, but, you know, certainly most people that were likely to hang around where they'd sort of do this little bit of a buy-in with the company and then over time you could increase your shares. And, you know, certainly the intention was to go down that road and stay there for quite a while. And me and one of the other guys that I was really good mates with, we were both sort of, you know, very, very, very minor shareholders, like nothing essentially. But anyway, we had our toe in the door. Certainly not the whole foot yet, but we were there, and that was the long term. There was no intention really to do anything else. But then, you know, the sale of the company sort of came a little bit left field, and so Air Whitsunday got sold on, as you know. And you know, nothing really changed. It was great. There was, you know, the caravans came along, and it was fantastic times. But that longevity outlook started to change a little bit, and so then you sort of start to get that, you know, little feeling in the back of your neck and go, well, you know, I wonder. And it was about that, I mean, Duncan had left and gone up to the Mallards, and then a year or two later Andrew Popper had left and he'd gone up to the Mallards, and then Dunk rang up one day and said, well, you know, we're sort of thinking that we might be looking for someone else. Who is there, anyone there that you know, you think might be keen? And I sort of stumbled for an answer a little bit, and then I said, well, you know what, Dunk, I maybe wouldn't mind having a crack at it myself. And then Dunk said, well, you know, there's a bit to be done, because at that time I didn't have my instrument rating and I didn't have my twin rating, but Dunk had sort of indicated that, you know, if you knock those things over and come up and have a chat, and, you know, all we can do is go from there. I mean, you know, we still had to meet all the other guys and go through the process and do all that sort of stuff. So really, it was that bit of a kick then to go, okay, well, geez, if I want to have a crack at this. I mean, you know, the Mallard was well known and there were so many people from Air Whitsunday. It was a bit of a legendary thing to go, oh, you know, you can get up there and, you know, twin IFR on the water still and all the rest of it. And so it was that sort of inkling or thinking about it and going, well, you know, if I'm going to do something, this is probably it and now's probably the time. So all of a sudden, you know, the motivation was there and I was off down to Mackay and, you know, pretty much that next week, I think, and just started every day off I had, you know, down there studying and flying and getting that instrument rating done and getting that, getting the twin stuff sorted. And so it took, I don't know, probably a couple of 6 months, maybe, I'm guessing, but to get all that done. And then, we jumped on a flight. I thought we'd better sort of go and see what Kat thinks about this as well. So we jumped on a flight, went up to Darwin in, you know, November, absolute worst time to be there and just sweating bullets and, you know.
Yeah,
just,
not a great time to show the wife Darwin, mate.
No, but I thought, well, you know, if she can handle it then she can handle it in any time. So so we sort of did the run around Darwin and went and had a chat to the guys and everything and, you know, met Bruce and the old chief pilot there. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, to be honest. But yeah, anyway, met all the guys and had a chat. And then, you know, the answer was, well, basically, if you want to come up, then let's go. And so it would have been probably March the year after, I think, that, you know, went back to Airwick Sunday and got things organised there. And, you know, we had a house in Airlie at the time, so we had to sort that out. So there was a bit to be done in Airlie. So we packed up the house and packed up the dogs and got everything organised and, yeah, jumped in the two cars with all our worldly possessions and wandered up to Darwin to start the new chapter.
Yeah, right. Is it like, you know, the chief pilot of a Airwet Sunday and seaplane company, you know how like sometimes a pilot will just kind of shave the beard all of a sudden and everyone's just like, when's a job interview? You know, is that like you going down to Mackay to do your instrument rating? Was everyone just like on edge? Like, where's Coey going?
Yeah, I think there was a bit of that. I remember leaning on the floats of the caravan there one day and I can't remember who was there. I think it was Damo, certainly Mick East, and you know, everyone's going, what's going on? And I'm like, yeah, look, I'm gonna go after the mallard. So, you know, but yeah, you can't keep things like that secret for too long, exactly. Can you? Everybody knows what's going on pretty quick smart.
Yeah, absolutely. So mate, how did you find it jumping onto the mallard? You know, what were the big differences and how did you handle it all?
It was, as you well know, it was pretty full on. You know, I'd gone up there with some expectations. You know, I thought I'm certainly going to be well out of my depth. You know, it's a whole new ball game, but I sort of thought, you know, I've got some decent water experience. I mean, I'd done 2000 hours on the Beaver and didn't do that much on the caravan, did about 400 maybe on the caravan, but, you know, I had some good water experience and good bit of turbine stuff there. But I thought, you know, the twin and the IFR and all that, you know, I'm going to struggle. I'm going to be out of my depth, but you know, the water side of it, I should sort of hold my own. And, you know, it was basically completely the opposite. I mean, that thing is just, you know, can be such a beast on the water. It was just, Jesus, hang on. and so, you know, look, the IFR stuff, yes, that was a steep learning curve, you know, and the procedurally, you know, spending hours and hours and hours, you'd fly, you know, we'd do the big trip through to Broome and we'd do all stops and then we'd get to Broome and wash the plane and wander off to the hotel and you'd sort of, you know, grab a quick beer and something to eat and then you'd go and hide in the room and read the Jeps, you know, because you'd stuffed up 15 radio calls that day because, you know, we in the wet Sundays, we just didn't do it. We had no... There were, you know, who did we speak to? You know, you'd be chatting to your mate going, oh, yeah, hey, I'm leaving the lagoon now. I'll see you at Whitehaven. And, you know, procedurally there was nothing. And all of a sudden you're in, you know, IFR airspace and Darwin with the tower and being a training tower and they're so, you know, 100% accuracy and, you know, that stuff, you know, I certainly don't mean to downplay the IFR. There was a very steep learning curve there, but you know the water stuff was what just amazed me. I mean, I just couldn't get over where you could put that aeroplane and what you could do with it. You know, one of those very early on with Bruce and you know rough water and down the back of Ansittard and that little creek approach right up the back of the bay there, and you know you're basically doing almost an ag approach, you know, the wings are through the trees and, you know, you're looking at this little bit of water going, are we actually going to stop in there? And, yeah, just amazing what they could do. And then, you know, you get it to a stop and then you go, well, how the hell do we get out of here? Because there's no, you know, there's no way that we've got a clear run of anything, but, you know, up on the step and then kick it 90 degrees and parallel the reef. And yeah, they're just, the maneuverability on the water is just something else, you know, and coming from, you know, the float plane world, that low center of gravity in the hull, and the speedboat performance on the water, that was, yeah, that just blew me away. That took a lot of getting used to. And, you know, the as a couple of people have mentioned, I think you mentioned as well, but the porpoising side of it, you know, I remember there one day just sitting there going, geez, am I going to actually get this? Because I'm struggling. And, you know, Andrew Popper, who I said had gone up before, you know, he'd been there a good period of time before me anyway, but, you know, not that long. And you're flying with these guys that you're going, wow, they're so smooth. They're just all over it. Nothing's an issue, you know, and then you swap seats and all of a sudden, you know, you're porpoising and pushing and pulling and throwing and they're looking at you going, what are you doing? And so, you know, it was a leveler, that's for sure. But, you know, that it comes, you do the time and you get the feel and all of a sudden it just clicks and then you go, what was that all about? Why was I struggling so much? But, you know, it just took a bit of time to get used to the machine and, you know, the difference, because you'd be doing a takeoff at max takeoff weight, and then you'd fly, you know, sometimes 15 mile and dump all those people, and then the next takeoff you're empty, and the performance between the two takeoffs is just, you know, chalk and cheese. So there was a lot of difference in the operation, in how we were running the machines. And so, yeah, it was a very steep learning curve. And, you know, we didn't do the right seat at that time either. It was straight into the left seat and straight into ICUS. And so I think in that first 6 months, so did the command, or did, you know, got through the ICUS to check to line stage. So got the command endorsement in basically smack on 6 months. But, you know, in that 6 months, we'd done 400 hours or thereabouts. So, you know, we were flying a lot. So,
yeah, right.
And then all of a sudden, yeah, I mean, having said that we didn't do the first officer type thing, you still were flying with very experienced people. So you were never out there with, you know, they're not going to throw the brand new captain with the brand new FO. So, you know, you had well-qualified guys sitting beside you all the time. So, yeah, it was great. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're off and you're, okay, we'd do the run through to Broome and the overnight, and you'd go, all right, well, I'll fly down and you can fly home, or, you know, swap halfway if you want or whatever, but pretty much just figured it out with your mate and off you went. So, yeah, good times. That was great.
It's certainly, just taking a step back there about the porpoising kind of stuff, it's certainly it knocks you down in confidence a little bit, doesn't it? You know, like I remember when I was in Vietnam there, I was doing a bit of instructing in the ride, or just kind of ICUS flying, I guess, and you'd have these, like I was teaching the Vietnamese kind of to be captains, and you'd get them on the step and I could literally feel how much the control column had to be pulled back or forward just so slightly, and you just knew as soon as you pulled it back or forth, that thing would just leap up. Like you ended up having such a good understanding of how where you were on the step in regards to those aeroplanes. And then as soon as you get on the Mallard there, it just beats you down, doesn't it? You just can't get it right. And then, like you said, the weight changes, you know, you're at max takeoff weight on the water, or you're now a ton and a half lighter and the thing just wants to leap. It does take a long time. And it's kind of great hearing these stories from you guys, like, you know, the past generation of Mallard pilots, that they also struggled, because I know everyone who comes here, we fight the same stuff, you know.
It's great. You know, I've enjoyed hearing it from everybody as well, because I'm sort of like, hey, it wasn't just me.
And even Steers, like over in Virgin Islands, you know, to hear that they were fighting it, you know, 20, 30 years ago as well, you know, even nearly 40 years, I think.
It's amazing, isn't it? But, you know, I did a lot of my training with Hoss, and, you know, he was great, but he was one of those people. I mean, you know, Dunk had, Bruce had, everybody had, but, you know, Hoss was, I just remember him saying that, you know, that the hull can catch you out so quick. You've got to be so on top of it. And, you know, he said, if you think you're struggling with this, you should have been in a Buccaneer or a Renegade, you know. And I'm like, yeah, okay, right. Well, I've been in one once and I didn't fly it. I was just sitting in the back thinking, my God, what is this thing? But yeah, the Mallard was just fantastic.
Yeah. Now, mate, I've spoken pretty regularly about kind of the work we're doing at the moment. We're servicing a couple of Pearl Farms. We're going to Broome occasionally, and we're also looking at doing a lot more commercial work. What was it like back in, you know, what was that, about 15 years ago, flying the Mallard? Like, what kind of flying were you doing? What was it like to do a daily flight as a flight crew on the Mallard?
Yeah, it was great. I'll drag you back a couple of years there, because it wasn't quite that long ago, but hey, it's close enough.
15? So that was probably,
would have been, well, actually, no, you're probably right. 14, yeah. 14 years ago when I first went there. So yeah, no, you're probably right. Yeah, time gets away. Yeah,
exactly.
Must be getting old. But yeah, look, research. It was done more than I have, by the sound of it. it was, as I say, you know, I went there straight in the left seat, but it was busy. I mean, this was all sort of, you know, pre-GFC and pre any sort of slowdown, and things were things were just, you know, all guns blazing. It was great. But, you know, the Coburg was still operational. So you'd do your sort of up to the northeast to the two farms up at the Coburg, and then heading sort of west, heading over to Broome, and you'd do, you know, we'd regularly do all stops to Broome, and, you know, quite often, very often overnight. It was pretty rare. If we went all the way to Broome, you wouldn't come back unless it was a direct flight back for some reason, you know, just a ferry. But it would basically be, you know, quite a few days where you'd go up to the Coburg, do those two, come back to Darwin, load up again, and then you'd do the run, you know, Hannah Perks, Vansittart, down to the Kimberley, and you'd do Vansittart over to the Osbornes, then over to Currie Bay, up to Talbot Bay, out to Cone Bay. We were going to Cone Bay there a lot, and then into Broome, you know, and so you might have done 7, 8, even 9 hours, and, you know, 6, 7, 8 water landings for the day. So, you know, there was some pretty big days in there, that's for sure. And then you'd get up, and we might do, you know, from Broome quite often, you'd go out to Talbot or Talbot and Currie, back to Broome, load up again, and then you'd do all stops from Broome back through to Darwin. So, you know, some pretty big days in there, that's for sure. But, you know, on the other hand, you'd on the Friday quite regularly, you might just do the Coburg and back and, you know, knock off for the day. So, yeah, good times.
And you flew out to the Montebellos as well, down to the southwest of Broome there. What were they like?
Yeah, that was unreal. You know, that was one of the, you know, when you talk about sort of folklore of, you know, oh, the Montebellos, and, you know, occasionally you get to go down there and they're this amazing, you know, island chain. And I mean, I'd never even heard of them. I had no idea what they were talking about. And then when you start to research a little bit and you realise that, you know, the nuclear history that was used by the British for nuclear testing in the 50s, and you know, well, I had some idea that went on, but I really had no idea where. And then, yeah, when you get down there, I mean, just such a stunning place. This, you know, nothing really out of the water by more than about a meter. You know, these amazing reefs and lagoons and beaches, and but you know, you can't go anywhere. Everything's, you know, everything's off limits. There's signs everywhere that, you know, radiation levels and all that. So, you know, you can sort of sit on the water and do what you're there for. And there was a pearl farm there, and we were down there to, you know, pick up and drop off and do whatever it was that we were doing, and then you'd sort of scoot out again. But yeah, just, you know, just incredible. I mean, you know, basically a thousand nautical mile from Darwin. So, you know, that's a big trip. You know, we didn't obviously go, we'd do the run through to Broome, and then we'd overnight there, and then we'd do down to, you know, Karratha, out to the Monties, back to Karratha, or direct back to Broome and overnight again, and then sort of, you know, head back north. But, you know, that's a long way to go for, yeah, you know, running around with the ute, you know, servicing the pearl farms, isn't it? It was incredible. But I think I definitely did two, might have been three trips down there. Went down a couple of times. But yeah, I remember one day there with Duncan, you know, and we dropped an anchor because we were waiting for whatever reason. And, you know, you're sitting there sort of having a chat, and then you're like, let's get the fishing line out. So, you know, there's a little fishing line rolled up in the survival kit in the back of the mallard there. So, you know, I don't think we even had any bait, but, you know, you just sit there with the handrail just for the photo opportunity, and just sort of going, wow, how amazing is this? You know, here we are at this incredibly remote sort of island group in the middle of nowhere, and this is what we're paid to do.
Yeah, it's pretty epic. And Coe, you're also at the, you spoke a little bit about Talbot Bay. Now, that's pretty famous for being around those horizontal waterfalls. Now, obviously these days there's an operation there that runs 5 caravans seasonally on floats to a huge big pontoon setup. But you were there before there was any float planes, and you saw the first float planes coming in.
Yeah, so we, you know, I remember when I first started on the Mallard, and, you know, it was a busy place because the horizontal falls were well known. Everybody wanted to see them, but it was very much a flyover and take photos. And, you know, the brief was always be careful around Talbot Bay because there'd be 206s and, you know, air vans and islanders and whatever it happened to be, but there'd be always these aeroplanes doing orbits over the falls taking photos. And, you know, we'd be ducking in there, and, you know, the Pearl Farm was basically right along that stretch of water, you know, almost to the falls, and that's where we were landing the Mallard. So, you know, it was really interesting to see. And I mean, that, you know, as you say, that's such a incredible operation that they run there now with, you know, the helicopters and the boats, and it's just amazing. But it was really interesting to see that transition through that, and to see, you know, Rod Johnson was up there with the Beaver. There was a couple of different, you know, people with caravans. And then, yeah, the good old story about the 185s from Drew, that was amazing. I mean, we were on the Mallard at the time, and you know, all of a sudden, these 185s on straight floats turn up. You're like, where did they come from? So yeah, that was hilarious listening to Drew's version of that. You know, on his version from the podcast. That was just such a cool story.
Absolutely. So, mate, how long did you actually end up spending on the Mallard there?
So I think it was just going on towards 3 years. Three years pretty much on the Mallard.
And then what was the next step after that?
And then, decided to do something completely different for a while, and we jumped over to surveillance onto the Dash 8 there for the offshore border protection gig. So jumped over there for about the same time, probably maybe a little bit less, about two and a half years. Over there. So yeah, whole different ball game all of a sudden, you know. I mean, we were sort of two crew on the Mallard anyway, but you know, real life the airline, you know, two crew, CRM, you know, dual FMS and flight directors and autopilots, and yeah, it was was an experience, that's for sure.
Did you regret leaving the Mallards at all at that time, or were you kind of, you know, so deeply involved in that new kind of world, like you said, of all these new toys, I guess, in the aeroplane of the Dash 8 that you kind of didn't really focus at all on the Mallard?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I've always said I'd love to go back to, you know, to float flying. But you know, at the time you go, well, look, I've made a decision and it's new and it's learning and it's, you know, we did some pretty cool stuff there as well. You know, so yeah, no, look, it was sort of a little bit of those never look back type things, I think. And you know, I had some really good times there, and it was great training and put me, you know, really in good stead for some of the stuff that I went on to, you know, later on with, you know, the RFDS type stuff. So yeah, look, it was good. I enjoyed my time there, put it that way. But you know, it was a very different world as well, and it was something, I mean, you know, that, as you know, with the Mallard, it's such a, yes, it's two crew, but it's such a small, close-knit group that, you know, really it's sort of flying around having a great time with your mates. You know, the two crew side of it is, you know, well rehearsed, and we take it very seriously, obviously, but you know, essentially you're doing it with people that you know, and you know, have a beer with at the end of the day, and it was great, you know. And all of a sudden it was, you know, a bigger operation, and people could be from, you know, come and you'd be flying with somebody from Broome or Adelaide or Cairns, or you know, so it was all a bit different. Was certainly an eye opener, that's for sure. And you know, I had had to work pretty hard to up the game in that different environment. I can tell you, you know, as you know, the Mallard, you don't there's not even a flight director, so you know, yeah, all of a sudden you're playing in a whole different field, that's for sure.
Now, mate, I don't know if you had to listen to the last or a couple of episodes ago with the great Shane McCauley. He made mention of you being the one that he knew. You worked with Kat at Vincent.
Yep.
Do you take credit for Shane being on the journey he's on today?
I don't know if I can really take credit for it, but it's certainly certainly awesome to hear, that's for sure. Love listening to his episode, and you know, I did say to Kat, I said, you know, you got a bit of a mention in there as the girl from Vincent Aviation, and it was that was such a good time. I mean, all those boys at Vincent, they were just such a good fun group. You know, you're sort of going, where did this mob come from? They were just, you know, larger than life and living life, just having so much fun, you know. And we did a couple of sort of cool trips there, jumped in the 1900 and did a lap out to, you know, Groot and to the club there one night just for a bit of a promo, and you know, got to know a few of the guys there, and yeah, no, they were great and really cool. I didn't realize that Shane had done that bit of a stint in the Maldives, so yeah, that's unreal. That makes me a little bit jealous. I wouldn't mind the, you know, just to throw the Twin Otter in the logbook there. I mean, yeah. That wouldn't be bad at all.
Well, Coe, sounds like you're doing pretty well, mate. Had an amazing career, and you know, it's really cool and great to listen to your story of your journey through float planes and, you know, even skydiving and now into the RFDS. We're coming to the pointy end of the podcast, mate. I'd like to finish off with a little questionnaire, the Splash and Dash questionnaire. You know, just like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane Splash and Dash. We'll just touch on a few questions. I'd like to firstly start off with, mate, what's a favourite seaplane that you've ever flown?
Mate, for me, I'm going to say the Caravan. Just, you know, a lot of people say it's a bit underpowered or whatever, but for me it was just the product of the time and what we were doing and the transition off the Beaver into the turbine world. And it just holds such a special place for me that, you know, particularly PGB, that was always my favourite. And, you know, I'd jump in that aeroplane any day of the week. I'd love it.
Awesome. You got a lake, you've got a river, open ocean, or a coral cay, let's say Hardy Reef or Blue Lagoon. What's the best place to land in?
Mate, the best place, I think, you know, you can't really go too far past the reef. You know, it's great. I mean, you know, you get on the romantic journey about flying in far north Canada and all that, but then you think, geez, mate, if I fall off the floats or something, that's a whole different ball game, you know. So, yeah, I think, you know, floats, to me, floats has got to be flown with, you know, no shoes, or even if you've got something, a pair of thongs and a pair of shorts, that's got to be the one.
Yeah, fair enough. What would be your dream seaplane to fly? If you could go back and fly anything out there, doesn't have to worry about money or anything, just pick any one seaplane that you would love to fly.
To go back, I mean, really, if you ever had the opportunity, I don't think you could go past the Mallard, really, could you? I mean, just such a capable aeroplane. You look at the one that was, you know, flown around privately there for a while all around the world, and you just see that, you know, you've got the legs, you've got the range, you can really go places. I mean, you know, most float planes are a 50-mile machine, aren't they? But, you know, all of a sudden the Mallard with the speed and everything, it's something else.
And finally, mate, what kind of advice would you give to anyone being an aspiring seaplane or wanting to get into the float plane industry, you know, coming from a chief pilot perspective, I guess, or, you know, just a seaplane experience perspective? What kind of advice would you give for someone wanting to get in?
I don't think you can go too far past what everybody's sort of touched on already, and that's, you know, you've got to have your endorsement. You've got to show people you're keen. You've got to get out and, you know, make the acquaintances, get in their ear, let them know what you're up to. But, you know, I think, you know, Shane touched on a very valid point as well, which is, you know, and Duncan and people like that are in the same boat, but people that come from a water background have just got so many advantages. If you've been kiteboarding or you've been sailing or whatever it is that you've been doing for all those years, if you can read the water, if you can see the bullets, if you can know what the wind direction is without even having to think about it, like those are skills that just add to your toolbox for, you know, when you jump in with somebody, you're like, oh, check that out, it's, you know, 12 knot northeast and blah blah blah, and they're looking at you going, well, how did you know, you do know what you're talking about. So I think things like that all add to the tool bag as well when you're trying to prove your point that you're worthy of the start.
Yeah, sounds good. Great advice, mate. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Coey, having you on the show here, mate, to really appreciate you taking the time to, or out of your busy schedule, to tell your stories and have a little chat with me about your career in seaplane flying. And Lloyd Cofield, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on The Step.
My absolute pleasure, Dan. It's a great series that you've got going, and yeah, some great information. So, absolute pleasure.
Appreciate it, mate. All right, all the best.
Cheers, Dan.
And that's the episode for today, folks. Thanks to Lloyd Cofield for making the time to share his story for all of us seaplane nerds out there. I know he's one as well. It really was a fun chat for sure. Next week, folks, we are doing something a little bit different here at On The Step. I'm calling it Maintenance Week. I've got two awesome interviews all about seaplane maintenance, including maintaining twin otters in the Maldives and being the chief engineer of the Mallard engineering team. It certainly opened up my eyes a bit to the maintenance world of seaplanes, and it's something you're all going to love. But until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.